The toucan is one strange-looking bird. Toucans have enormous, ungainly beaks, the biggest in the animal kingdom when you take into account the size of that bird. If you've ever wondered what good that bill is, here's a surprising new answer. It can work like your car's radiator. NPR's Richard Harris explains.
Biologist Glenn Tattersall works at Brock University in Chile, Ontario. So you can hardly be surprised that he tries to spend at least a month a year doing his field work in the tropics. One of the creatures that draws him there is the toucan with its enormous, colorful bill.
You can't help but look at them and really wonder what they're thinking when they have this, just to see the way they have to cope with having such a large bill.
Charles Darwin suggested the ornate bill was all about, shall we say, courtship. Others have suggested the long bill is a fruit-picking device to improve the bird's reach up in the trees. But any field biologist who has ever held a toucan has noticed something else about the bill.
You can feel it with your hand if you held the bill. You could feel the warmth from it.
That got Tattersall and his colleagues wondering, could the bill actually be part of how toucans keep themselves at a comfortable temperature?
The initial question was not that the bill could be used as a radiator, because we knew that it was warm. We wanted to know whether it could be shut down.
Can toucans turn it on and off, and by so doing regulate their body temperature? Elephants keep their cool by controlling blood flow to their ears, so this is not a crazy idea. To find out, Tattersall decided to use his infrared camera, the same kind that the military and cops use for night surveillance, to measure changes in heat flow from the toucan's bill. In one experiment he described in Science magazine, Tattersall chased a bird around a very large cage for about 10 minutes. He wanted to see whether the bird's bill would heat up to keep it cool as it exerted itself. And yes, indeed it did.
It went from air temperature to essentially body temperature.
So do you think the bill evolved for the purpose of being a radiator?
I doubt that that's the case.
So then that sort of begs the question, doesn't it? Why does the toucan have the giant bill if it didn't evolve to keep the bird cold?
Yep. Well, sadly, still don't have the answer to that question.
That's really more a question for an evolutionary biologist like Jason Weckstein at the Field Museum in Chicago. He agrees that the enormous bill probably did not evolve to keep the birds cool, even though it now serves that purpose.
If birds really need radiators like this, why don't we see these crazy, wild, ungainly bills more commonly in birds that are living in similar environments to toucans?
Weckstein says the bill may have evolved along with other social traits in toucans. It turns out that toucans tend not to be the go-along-and-get-along sorts of creatures. Many are actually quite aggressive with one another. And Weckstein says gaudy big bills are part of this shtick.
Toucans that have the largest bills are kind of the most social birds that are most likely to have these kind of aggressive displays.
Weckstein, believe it or not, actually studies not only toucans, but the lice that live on them. And here, he says, the bill is clearly a liability.
It turns out that big-billed birds are really bad at getting parasites off of them.
So what's interesting about lice? Who would want to study lice on a toucan?
That's what my wife always asks me.
He actually has a pretty good answer to that question, but oops, we're out of time. Richard Harris, NPR News.
It is hot. Here in Southern California, we're having a heat wave, temperatures in the 90s, the hundreds in some places. I know I shouldn't complain because, well, the weather here is usually perfect, and it's summer after all. It's supposed to be hot. Still, a lot of us are wondering, how much heat can a person stand? Well, here's an answer from our science correspondent, Robert Krulwich.
Our subject is when it's even hotter than frying eggs on the sidewalk hot. Bernd, are you there?
Yeah, I'm there, Robert.
Okay, Bernd Heinrich, esteemed biology professor from the University of Vermont. Let's begin with a fact most people know. Water boils at 212 degrees Fahrenheit when you're down at sea level. So you got to wonder, what would happen if you, say, stepped into a room heated to 211 degrees, just a single degree shy of boiling, and then ever so slowly you made that room just a little bit hotter? Would your blood start to boil? In your book, Summer World, you describe how once somebody actually tried this.
Yeah.
More than 230 years ago, around 1775, at the Royal Society in London, three very prominent gentlemen, Sir Charles Blagden, doctor and chemist, Sir Joseph Banks, botanist and explorer, and Dr. Daniel Solander, naturalist, also an explorer, they decided to conduct a heat experiment inside a room of their own design.
A small room, 10, 15 feet or something like that square, and they put a metal stove in there and they got a heating it red hot, and so they conducted experiments and observation in a heated room.
And those experiments, says Professor Heinrich, began with the room at 210 degrees. Then they moved it up to 211, and one by one the gentlemen entered reported it unpleasantly hot but very bearable. So they made the room hotter to 212, to 220, to 230.
They got it up to 240 or even more. Yeah, 30 or more points above the boiling point of water.
And Sir Charles, was he...
Blogden stayed apparently 8 minutes at 240 degrees, and afterwards he felt he could have actually stayed even longer. So this is an amazing thing, but there are certain conditions involved here.
First of all, the air in that room was dry, not wet heat, it was dry heat. Then the gentleman didn't move around, hardly at all. And third, and this is the most important, Sir Charles reported almost immediately he began sweating.
Sweating profusely.
And that, why is that important?
Well, the sweat is removing heat.
Meaning when you sweat and then the sweat evaporates, that act of evaporation pulls heat away from your skin. When water on your skin turns to gas, the heat gets removed. So you sweat some more, then there's more evaporation. And as long as you keep up this sweating, evaporating, the air right around your skin never gets too hot because evaporation protects you.
So that tiny, thin layer of air right next to your skin, maybe it's only millimeters or so, that little space is being cooled.
And that's what keeps you from burning or boiling?
Yeah, by your body temperature, by the evaporating water, we can cool the whole body through the sweating.
But what happens if you can't sweat? Well, to find that out without doing anybody serious harm, Sir Charles brought a chicken egg, chicken eggs, after all, don't sweat, into the room with him. And what happened to the egg?
Well, it was cooked solid because the egg doesn't sweat. Of course, a beefsteak can evaporate water for quite a while.
Boy, I did forget. They also did bring a juicy beefsteak into the room.
But the beefsteak in 33 minutes got dry, and then it got really hot, and then it cooked.
So this is a hooray for sweat story is what this is.
Exactly. It shows the power of sweating, and which is an amazing power that humans have.
Well, let's be careful here, because I understand there was a non-human involved.
Well, they said they had a 32-pound bitch. By that, they mean a little...
Being a family radio station, we have to ask you to explain that.
Well, that's a female dog.
Okay, so they bring a dog with them.
Yeah, and the dog stays in there at 220 degrees Fahrenheit for half an hour, and actually during that time it's in there, the temperature rises to 236, and the dog comes out, it's panting, it's perfectly all right.
And 1 month later, says Sir Charles, the dog was still perfectly brisk, showing that if you cool yourself either on the inside through panting or on the outside through sweating, either way, it is apparently possible to survive temperatures at least for a little while that would normally boil water. Robert Krulwich, NPR News.
Annual mating frenzy of horseshoe crabs on the beaches of Delaware Bay. The results of that giant orgy? Billions of crab eggs covering the shore. That's where we start today's installment. It's a tale of gluttony by tens of thousands of shorebirds who fly in to gorge themselves on those eggs. Quite a few human visitors come along as well. This year, Louisa Jonas from member station WYPR in Baltimore is one of them.
A lanky man in a floppy hat and windbreaker is hiding behind shrubbery on a beach in Miss Pillion Harbor.
Put myself really low and just literally nose forward.
Nigel Clark is from the British Trust for Ornithology. He's peering through his scope, trying to read tags on the legs of hundreds of migratory shorebirds feeding in front of him.
Ah, I think I can just see Brazilian marked bird. It's amazing on these beaches just to think that we can see birds that we know have been marked in Brazil or Argentina. The very southern tip of South America, right at the southern tip of Terra del Fuego. That's where the majority of these birds are coming from.
Nigel is particularly interested in the redknot, a chestnut-colored bird about the size of a robin. The redknots winter in Argentina, but fly 10,000 miles to the high Arctic to breed. To prepare for their journey, they shrink their own digestive organs and turn the tissue into fuel to burn in flight. By the time they look down on the shores of the Delaware Bay, they're really hungry.
When a bird arrives, they are literally skin and bone. Very little on them at all. They look very thin, sleek birds running around with extremely long legs, it seems.
Delaware is the redknot's most important feeding stop on their trip. They time their arrival to perfectly coincide with the annual horseshoe crab spawning here. The crabs lay billions of pearly green caviar-sized eggs. Many of these eggs would just dry out or wash away, but instead they become a banquet for the migratory shorebirds.
So the birds feeding on really the surplus eggs in the population, it really is a case of nature's bounty that they're taking, rather than a fact that the birds are stopping the crabs breeding.
The redknots only have a few weeks to build up enough fat reserves to fuel their last leg of their journey. They eat so greedily that stretches of sand can be completely hidden by their red breasts and little pecking heads.
By the time they're ready to go, they are like little balls, is the best way of putting it. They are round. They look like they have short legs because they are carrying so much fat on their breast, and they almost waddle. They are so heavy.
So I think we should celebrate the knot of arrival.
Nigel heads back to a beach house not far from Miss Pillion Harbor. He's one of 20 or so volunteers who gather here every year as part of the Delaware Shorebird Project. There are sleeping bags in every corner, tide and moon charts on the walls. A sign on the oven reads, "Do not touch, drying feathers."
When we fire the net, we need to get people out to it very quickly. Be very careful.
Jackie Clark is Nigel's wife and also works for the trust. She says the bounty of crab eggs in Delaware that's available only in late spring is an example of nature's mysterious synchronicity. The redknots need that fuel to get to the Arctic to breed, and they need to get there exactly when there will be plenty of food for their chicks. And that's only for two short months in the summer.
But hopefully they get the timing just right. It's really critical. They arrive just as the snow melts, and they can lay their clutch of eggs really quickly. Then, as their chicks hatch, it should be just about the same time the insects hatch as well. So the chicks get the maximum food.
But something's gone wrong for the redknots. Nigel says the population's crashed since the 1990s. The redknot is a candidate species under the Endangered Species Act. Climate change may be affecting when the ground thaws in the Arctic. There may not be enough horseshoe crab eggs in Delaware to fatten up the birds. The volunteers head off the next morning to see if the birds are gaining enough weight. On the beach at Miss Pillion Harbor, the team sets up a cannon net, which uses gunpowder to blast a net over hundreds of feeding shorebirds. Wings flap, and the birds bounce up and down like popcorn, struggling to escape.
Okay, there's plenty of tombstones here.
Take a handful.
The volunteers gently peel back the net and lift the birds out, sometimes two or three in a handful, and place them into ventilated boxes. The team gets to work, weighing, measuring, banding, and taking feather samples.
Hello. One more. There we go. Here you go, baby.
The crew returns to the beach house. Nigel and the other volunteers crunch the data with hopes that the birds are plumping up. Soon, they'll have to fly 2,500 miles to the Arctic in 5 days without stopping.
Red Knot and Delaware Bay in the Americas is absolutely intertwined and critical. There is nowhere else in the world where a population of birds is so dependent on such a small area. And if they don't have Delaware Bay, they won't get to the Arctic, they won't breed, and the population will die out. It's as simple as that.
This year turns out to have been a pretty good year for the red knots in Delaware. But in order for the population to recover, the birds need several good years in a row. Not just in Delaware, but in Argentina and in the Arctic. For NPR News, this is Louisa Jonas.
Think of this next report as the triumph of the little guy. In this case, the little guy is a moth. A species of tiger moth in the southwestern United States apparently learned to confuse a dangerous predator. Bats are among nature's cleverest predators, using ultrasonic signals to locate their prey at night. They make quick work of moths. But just as guerrilla fighters find ways to evade the superior technology of a large army, one species of tiger moth seems to be jamming the signals of enemy bats. NPR's Christopher Joyce reports on an ultrasonic aerial war.
In the bat-eat-moth world of the summer night, moths are at a distinct disadvantage. Bats can locate and snap up a moth out of midair with the greatest of ease. They use what biologists consider to be one of the animal world's most efficient tools of prey, ultrasonic signals that work like sonar. But Aaron Corcoran, a graduate student at Wake Forest University, was intrigued by a species of moth that also makes ultrasonic sounds. He wondered if this was some kind of bat deterrent. The moth, an orange species with a 4-inch wingspan called Bertholdia trigona, has organs on its body called timbals.
This timbal kind of works like a pop can, that if you push in on the side of a pop can, it'll make a click, and then as it releases out, it makes another click. We've measured up to 450 clicks in a tenth of a second. That's a tremendous amount of sound that this moth is making.
Corcoran removed the timbals from some of these moths and then tethered the insects. That's right, tethered them with fishing line so they could fly, but not too far. He brought in a bat and filmed what happened. The sounds have been slowed down so the human ear can hear them.
As a bat is flying around, it's constantly making chirps and listening for the echoes. And as it closes in on the insect, it increases the repetition rate with which it's making those sounds.
The tethered moths, the ones that could not click, got eaten. No problem at all for the bats. So what about an intact moth, with its timbals clicking away as the bat closes in? Corcoran tethered up some of these moths.
You hear the bat going through its normal progression and then starting to speed up, and then the moth turns on its sound production, which sounds almost like a siren because the pitch is going up and down. At that point, the bat does something very abnormal. It starts slowing down its repetition rate, the opposite of what it would normally be doing.
Here's what it sounds like. The rattle-like sound is the moth clicking. As soon as the rattle started, the bat got confused and missed the moth. This kept happening over and over, till the bat finally gave up and crawled back to its cage. Corcoran, who published his findings in the journal Science, ran the experiment several times with the same results. He's ruled out the idea that the sound just startles bats. The bats would have grown used to that and eventually had more success. Corcoran and his colleagues think it's some kind of ultrasonic jamming.
What appears most likely is that the clicks are interfering with the bat's neural processing of the echoes that are coming back.
Corcoran says if you live in the southwestern U.S., you just might catch some of this aerial action underneath a street light at night. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.